is Free Speech, radio news for Monday, October 25, 2004, at WBAI in New York. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Serbs boycott elections in Kosovo over the weekend, threatening the legitimacy of the multi-ethnic governance structure. The new government in Burma strengthens its military grip of the country. And with the presidential elections now just over a week away, today we look at key senatorial races. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 390 tons of high explosives are missing from a former Iraqi military installation. The facility was supposedly being guarded by U.S. military forces, but has been reportedly looted as recently as Sunday. Military officials say they have been overburdened with all of the weaponry found in Iraq. White House officials say senior advisors were made aware of the missing explosives, but are unable to ascertain whether George W. Bush was notified. Iraqis continually say better security is needed, while Bush administration officials often counter that upcoming elections in Iraq will put Iraqis in charge of their destiny. Peace activist Tom Fox, now working in Iraq, says the Iraqi campaigning process looks too much like a U.S. election.
From my perspective over here, I don't see a lot of depth of debating the issues. It seems to be we're falling back upon our old habits of trying to knock other people down to build ourselves up by trying to use little sound bites instead of having fully thought out ideas. So I think it's just basically another American political campaign.
Fox adds that U.S. elections will also determine the next leader of 25 million Iraqis. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon took his Gaza pullout plan to the Knesset today, saying it would make the country stronger. The plan that gives the Israeli military control over the air, sea, and border points around Gaza will face stiff opposition. Meanwhile, refugee camps in the Gaza Strip have been hit hard by the Israeli military. George Rishmawi has more from Bethlehem.
In the last 24 hours, about 14 Palestinians have been killed and over 15 homes been demolished in southern Gaza Strip in the city of Khan Yunis. In a military operation apparently started very early on Sunday morning. Basically, the army started shelling the area with the Apaches and later on moved to shelling from tanks, and opened their tank-mounted machine guns at Palestinians. There was a report today in Israeli media outlets, mainly on Haaretz, saying that the Israeli establishment is estimating that the Palestinian resistance has anti-aircraft weapons, and this is actually seen by local observers as a preparation for another military attack on Gaza Strip. For Free Speech Radio News, this is George Rishmawi from Bethlehem.
Over public discriminatory statements, European Union leaders will still consider a controversial candidate for justice minister. Diletta Varlese reports from Naples.
The next European Union's president, Manuel Durao Barroso, is still insisting that a controversial former Italian minister should be the Commission's Minister of Justice. Last week, Rocco Buttiglione was criticized by the EU Parliament's president due to his negative public declarations calling homosexual sinners and single mothers bad parents. Consequently, the former Italian minister presented a letter to the Commission with his apology. Barroso also added a small change to his candidacy. He will be placed side by side with four other commissioners to confirm his decision on matters of discrimination and human rights. Barroso himself will preside over the committee. But liberal, socialist, green and communist members of the EU Parliament say this proposal is unacceptable and insist it will not resolve the problem. While waiting for the parliamentary vote in 2 days, Barroso is trying to find an opening with a section that is against Buttiglione. But he is unyielding on his proposal for the Commission's composition. If this suggestion won't be accepted, he might risk a negative vote by the whole Commission. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese from Naples, Italy.
India's Prime Minister meets with a leader of Burma's military junta. Some say the move legitimizes the oppressive rule. Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad.
Pro-democracy Burmese groups living in exile in India have condemned and demonstrated against the visit to New Delhi by head of Burma's military, Senior General Than Shwe. The groups claim the visit encourages the military dictatorship and repressive rule in Burma. India has consistently supported the pro-democracy movements in Burma, but analysts feel the new alliance is to engage Burma to offset China's influence in the region. For the general, it's a rare trip out of his country, just 2 weeks after Burmese Prime Minister was ousted. Agreements on security, cultural exchanges, and energy projects are on the agenda between representatives of world's largest democracy and one of the military leadership in the region. From Ahmedabad in India, Benu Alex, Free Speech Radio News.
And we'll have more on Burma coming up. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Eligible voters in the Balkan province of Kosovo went to the polls over the weekend in what was the second parliamentary election since the United Nations and NATO assumed administrative control of the region 5 years ago. Although Kosovo is technically still part of Serbia and Montenegro, Kosovo's status is still unresolved, and the UN administration is touting the new assembly as the local government to steward Kosovo towards status discussions set for mid-2005. But a Kosovo-Serb boycott of the elections threatens the legitimacy of multi-ethnic governance, which is a condition of the international community if status talks are to take place. Melik Kermian of the Kosovo Radio Collective reports from Kosovo's capital, Pristina.
Less than 1% of Kosovo's ethnic Serb population took to the polls over the weekend, lending credibility to appeals made by Serbian leaders in Belgrade that Kosovo-Serb voter participation would legitimize the 120-seat parliament dominated by Kosovo's Albanian majority, all of whom advocate for Kosovo's independence from Serbia and Montenegro. One Kosovo Serb man who boycotted the election said discontent towards the international community and the interim Kosovo government was growing for both Albanians and Serbs. He declined to give his name. Throughout Kosovo, unemployment figures hover around 60%.
I expect that sure, there must be some changes after the elections. But as to what they will be, will they be a better or worse for the Serbs in Kosovo? We'll have to wait and see. We know our experience is up to now, but we cannot predict what will happen.
Kosovo's ethnic Albanians comprise about 90% of the population, and Albanian concerns dominate Kosovo's political landscape, even though the UN holds ultimate sway over all decision-making powers in Kosovo. Added to this equation are the 8 democratic benchmarks called standards for Kosovo that must be fulfilled before status talks even begin. One standard includes institutional guarantees of multi-ethnic governance, in which all Kosovo minorities be given equal decision-making powers in the legislature, something most Serbs in Kosovo assert is not happening. One Kosovo Serb politician, Oliver Jovanovic, broke rank with politicians in Serbia by calling on Kosovo Serbs to participate in the election. Jovanovic says that the Serbian government directly obstructed the voting process by putting pressure on Serbs not to vote.
Important events are ahead of us in 2005 and 2006. Those who are going to be elected must have full and unreserved support from Belgrade.
Jovanovic praised Serbian President Boris Tadic's decision to endorse Kosovo's Serb voter participation last weekend, although some political analysts say it was partly to appease threats by the U.S. government to withhold financial aid if the Serb leadership failed to endorse Kosovo's election process. Tadic's stance reflected the notion that if Serbia was to have more bargaining power over Kosovo's status, democratic participation in Kosovo's institutions was paramount. Ilir Dugoli, senior advisor to Kosovo's Albanian Prime Minister Bajram Recepi, agrees with this assessment.
We really would like to see them participating and as to contribute to use all the institutional means to express their grievances, their positions, their problems, and try through institutions, mainly through assembly, to resolve all the problems that they have in Kosovo.
Serb distrust in Kosovo's governance was aggravated by widespread riots in March, which targeted Serb and non-Albanians, leaving 19 people dead and 4,000, mostly Serbs, homeless. It was the worst ethnic violence in 5 years. Still, the Kosovo Serbs' distrust of both the UN and the interim government is matched in some ethnic Albanian circles as well. Many local analysts point to the fact that roughly half of the eligible Albanian voters went to the polls, indicating an increasing voter apathy rate. Albin Kurti, an activist with the civic group Kosovo Action Network, campaigned against the vote. He says that as long as the UN has ultimate power over the province, no exercise in voting will make a difference.
kemi votuar për institucione të cilat kanë qenë të privuara nga.
3 years ago we voted for institutions which were deprived of their sovereignty. For us it is absurd to once again vote for institutions when the ones who really have the power is the UN, who are institutionally untouchable. This is the reason why we think that voting in these elections does not represent building democracy, but moreover, it represents maintenance of a system which is not democratic at all.
The final election results indicate that the ruling Democratic League of Kosovo took the most votes with 46%, while the Democratic Party of Kosovo, led by a former Kosovo Liberation Army fighter, took 29%. For the two Serb parties that participated, 10 set-aside seats are guaranteed, regardless of the low voter turnout. This is the Kosovo Radio Collective reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Pristina, Kosovo.
While the focus during the election season falls squarely on the two presidential candidates, voters will also be choosing who'll get to be part of Congress and serve on Capitol Hill. In part due to last year's Texas redistricting, the GOP will likely continue its 10-year control of the House of Representatives. The Democrats will have their best shot of taking power in the Senate, where the GOP maintains a slim majority. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Mitch Jeserich takes a look at some of the key Senate races.
Senatorial candidates are as polished as anyone when it comes to election year speeches and debates, never saying anything too controversial, mindful not to sway too far to the left or to the right. One exception this year would be the Democratic Senate candidate in New Hampshire, Doris Haddock, also known as Granny D, the 94-year-old woman who has walked across the country for peace and campaign finance reform. In a debate last week against the Republican incumbent, Senator Judd Gregg, Granny D said she is more afraid of George Bush than Osama bin Laden. She also said Walmart is bad for the country, and she shared her thoughts on medical marijuana.
I think that the marijuana, if not legalized, at least should not be a jail sentence. I think it should be a fine. I think that I met so many people when I was out on a long trip trying to get people to vote. So often an African-American young man would say, I can't vote. I'm felon. I need that. That must be stopped.
In the poll, Senator Gregg has a large lead over Granny D, who at times seemed lost for words during their debate. While Gregg has about $20 million in his campaign chest, Granny D has been given little help from the Democratic Party, and she has just $80,000 to her name. Instead, Democrats are pouring their resources into more conservative senatorial candidates across the country, including Democratic Representative Brad Carson for the seat in Oklahoma. Though a Democrat, Carson touts many of his conservative values.
I have an A rating from the National Rifle Association, and so I assure you I have never voted against gun control. As it comes to abortion, I, as a Southern Baptist, am strongly opposed to abortion.
The U.S. Senate is commonly known as the rich white man's club. Of the current 100 senators, about half are millionaires, 86 of them are males, and 97 of them are white, without a single Latino or African American serving in the so-called senior body of Congress. There have only been 4 black senators in U.S. history, but it looks like Barack Obama will be the 5th. Obama, a state senator from Illinois, has a comfortable lead over Republican candidate Alan Keyes and will likely gain a seat for the Democratic Party by replacing retiring Republican Senator Peter Fitzgerald. Barack Obama.
What we did was we built a grassroots movement. And the fact of the matter is that I've got a track record of independence as a community organizer, as a civil rights attorney.
Obama's strongest opponent is Republican candidate Alan Keyes, who is also black, thus marking the first time the two major candidates facing off for a senatorial seat are African Americans. Some have accused the GOP of playing the race card by picking Alan Keyes as a last-minute replacement who didn't even reside in Illinois to challenge Obama. But Key says both Democrats and Republicans are guilty of not recruiting people of color for high offices. He also says he's tired of the race question.
Why is it that the first question people in the media ask isn't, how do you plan to rally and speak to Christian voters in Illinois? I'm a Roman Catholic, and yet I have yet to get a question from a reporter about how Alan Keyes, a Roman Catholic politician, is going to appeal to Roman Catholics who have traditionally voted Democrat.
While the Democrats have put much attention on Barack Obama, they're practically ignoring another black senatorial candidate in Georgia, former Judge Denise Majette, whose underfunded campaign has put her behind Republican challenger Johnny Isakson, for the seat being vacated by Democratic Senator Zell Miller. Democrats will have an uphill battle to regain control of the Senate, as their minority leader Tom Daschle is in a close race with Republican candidate John Thune in South Dakota. As well, several Democratic senators from Republican strongholds are also leaving their seats, including John Edwards from North Carolina. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
An estimated 7 million U.S. citizens live and work overseas. There's been a surge in overseas voter registration, with many more people registered than in previous elections. Democrats and Republicans alike have been working hard to influence the overseas vote that could just swing the election. But a week before this tight presidential race, thousands of overseas voters still have not received their ballots and likely won't be able to get them back in time. Naomi Fowler reports from a Democrat abroad meeting in London.
Despite the record number of voters registering, administrative problems may still prevent some from actually voting. The registration process was changed because of the problems in Florida in the last election. Carol Bell is one of the volunteers who had to understand the system quickly to help people register.
We were given very thick books with instructions. They couldn't be more difficult. If you're a lawyer, you still have to work hard to read them. I'm a lawyer, I know. And we were given batches of what's called federal write-in postcard ballots. The government did not supply enough of them. When we asked for more, the head of our registration drive, Margot Miller, asked for more, and she had a terrible time getting them. So when we couldn't get the booklets, I asked, well, who do we get the booklets from? And the answer was the Department of Defense, and everyone laughed. In other words, the current administration was in charge of seeing that there were enough booklets for registering.
Despite uncertainty for some voters and the confusion in getting to grips with the new system, voter registration volunteer and Democrat Herman Rothberger is happy at least with the enthusiasm.
I mean, Democrats abroad in the UK are very active. I mean, we increased our numbers. I think we've more than doubled in the last year, thanks to George Bush. It's great for recruiting. There's an overseas voting website, which I was told that there were 1,000 a day registering around the world. The news here is much more open, I think, than in America. I mean, recently I read a poll that said 58% of Americans with passports living overseas prefer Kerry to 35% would prefer Bush.
Democrats Abroad International Press Officer Sharon Manita has also been impressed by the strength of feeling this time round.
People feel passion, concern, very invigorated in a way that they haven't been in any of the elections I've worked on over here over the years. People feel empowered, they feel frustrated, but at the same time they know their vote will count. We know we have registered so many, 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 many more times the number of people that we did in 2000.
Robert Listman says he'll be voting Democrat in the election. His long time living overseas has increased his concern about the U.S. isolating itself from the rest of the world.
My biggest fear is that America will get attacked again. I think a vote for Bush will send a signal to the rest of the world, and to the Middle East in particular, that the American people have rubber stamped his previous policies and are happy with his stay in power, not just the military power and what's going on in Iraq, but its economic power as well. And I think that a continued presidency of George Bush will further alienate America. I think it cannot afford to lose many of its partners that have built up in the last 50 or however many years, really.
Europeans have taken a strong interest in this election. Sharon Manita of the Democrats Abroad.
Everybody I talk to over here, they are so passionate, and they just, you know, they just so desperately want to have an effect on the election. We had a voter registration effort in Copenhagen, and some Danish people came up, more than one, and said, if Bush wins, does this mean this will be the last election in the United States? That's the kind of fear that people have, non-Americans have, and are very, very worried.
From this Democrats Abroad meeting in London, this is Naomi Fowler for Free Speech Radio News.
The joint UN-Afghan electoral board announced yesterday that incumbent Afghan President Hamid Karzai looks likely to become the country's president after clinching more than half the votes cast in the October 9 election. His main rival, Yunus Kauni, an ethnic Tajik, has said he will accept the result only if irregularities in the vote were acknowledged by a panel of foreign investigators. And while the final result is still pending, some Afghans feel that whoever wins, they'll continue to live in poverty. That's certainly true of many refugees who have returned after fleeing the country during the long years of war. On the day before the election, Tony Cross met some of the refugees in the ruins of the former Russian Cultural Center in Kabul.
This is the Panjshir Valley, the heartland of the Northern Alliance during the war with the Taliban and against the Russians. To get into this valley, you have to pass under a giant gate with a picture of Ahmad Shah Massoud, the warrior leader of the Northern Alliance, who was killed by the Taliban's agents. And now we're in a village on the dusty side of magnificent mountains. On the walls here, there are some pictures of Yunus Kanuni, a candidate from the Panjshir Valley, but also a lot of pictures of Abdelhafiz Mansour, a Tajik nationalist candidate. Villagers tell us what they think of the election.
His name is Boz Muhammad.
Boz Muhammad, do you know how you're going to vote in the election?
Yes, I'm going to vote. I'm going to vote for Muhammad Yunus Qanuni. He was a Mujahid person, he's a Muslim person, and now I'm going to announce my support from him. I'm going to vote for him.
This area fought against the Russians. What do you think of the foreigners in the country now?
If they are doing something well for us, we are going to respect them. If they come for something else, we are going to be against of them.
And which do you think they're here for?
Now they are saying by themselves that we come here for peace, for unity, for everything, but we don't know for the future what they mean to here.
You can really see the signs of war around here along the road. A village is completely destroyed. On the way up, we saw some tanks in completely working order gathered by the side. They had actually been sold back in the program of buying back arms from the militias, the various militias and factions. But once we got into the Panjshir Valley, we also passed some tanks in working order and a lot of heavy artillery. I was going to take a photo, and one of our translators said, don't do anything here, this is very sensitive. These are arms which have not been sold back, although they're supposed to have done so. So peace, stability is not completely re-established here. So what is your name?
His name is Bariolai.
I believe that you were a Mujahideen at one time. Can you tell us what you're doing now?
Right now, I'm also a Mujahid.
You're also a Mujahid. And who are you fighting now?
If anyone here come like Al-Qaeda, like foreigners, we're happy to be against of him and fight with him.
And is there a risk of that still?
Yes, for sure, why not?
On a mountain which juts out into the Panjshir Valley, there's a small green dome building, quite modern. It's the mausoleum of Ahmad Shah Massoud. As we're speaking, two people are kneeling in front of an impressively decorated tomb. One of the guards of the tomb, Mehlar Ahmad, is with me. I wonder if you can tell me, first of all, do you think that Ahmad Shah Massoud would be pleased with the state of Afghanistan today?
He was such a person, but if he was alive, so everything was right.
In what way would it be better?
In my own opinion, the first thing, if Ahmad Shah Massoud was alive, he was opposite of Americans, so the American soldier was not in Afghanistan. We were happy with the ISAF, International Security Assistance Forces, but we were not happy with the American force in Afghanistan. The Afghanistan people hate them, because when in Palestine, in, for example, in other countries, when they fight there, their war, that's all from United States.
The Panjshiri leaders are resented in a lot of the rest of Afghanistan because they're believed to have abused the military power that they acquired during the war. So maybe feelings here aren't shared all over the country, but suspicion of the US can be found anywhere, and the politicians that the US backs have to take account of that. In the Panjshir Valley, I'm Tony Cross for Free Speech Radio News.
The world's biggest mangrove, called Sundarbans, is situated in the Bay of Bengal in India, and it's facing the threat of destruction. This national park, inhabited by tribal people, is an estuary mangrove ecosystem, as it's situated near the estuary of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra rivers. An Indian corporation, Sahara, has a $100 million tourism plan to make this, quote, a global standard tourist destination. Now forest officials have begun evicting the fishery communities living there so the corporation can go ahead with its plans, as Vinod Kejoz reports.
Roughly a third of Sunaban's delta is water, consisting of rivers, channels and tidal creeks up to 5 kilometers wide. The Sunaban's falls both within India and Bangladesh, the latter having the larger share of the delta. There is a national park on the Indian side overlooking the Bay of Bengal. 60 years ago, transient migratory fishing folk from today's Bangladesh came and settled in the Indian side of the delta. Kumar Das is one of the eldest members of fishermen in Jambudweep.
Many years ago, I crossed over the Bay of Bengal and the huge Ganges River to reach this delta. We've been living here fishing in the sea with peace until recently.
His community, that is Jalia's Kaibata community, is facing the threat of eviction from the delta. According to government, they are illegal occupants, and the delta in the sea is an illegal gateway to India. These are the reasons stated to them in the eviction notice. But the real reason seems to be an Indian corporate company's $100 million mega plan to convert the delta into a series of floating tourist cities. But the community doesn't want to leave the delta. For them, leaving means losing their livelihood. Madha Majid, a fisherman.
It has been home for us for decades. It is our motherland. No one can ask us to leave our home.
But the forest officials have to speed up the evictions since they already signed a memorandum of understanding with the Sahara Corporate Company. A.K. Raha, chief conservator of the Forest Department of the federal government.
If by maintaining environmental balance without disturbing the ecosystem, if somebody wants to do tourism, which should be ecotourism, ecological, sustainable tourism, why should we object to it?
The company has already acquired 2,500 acres of land, but the environmentalists say the tourism plan would move forward at the cost of 500,000 people's life. Hare Krishna is a local anthropologist.
The community has a vast traditional knowledge and wisdom. If you ask to move a community which knows only fishing as their livelihood, it will be nothing short of genocide in a different sense of the word.
Joy Das Gupta, senior anthropologist with the National University of Science.
That's what is amazing, that many decisions in this country are today being taken by a handful of people without really understanding what it really means for many other people. And that's a very worrisome factor.
In many communities throughout the world, culture and spiritual belief systems are tied to land and the way of life that goes along with it. This transient fisher community is no different.
Without Jambudweep, we'll die. How will we raise our children? How will we pray to our sea goddess?
From the Indian side of Sunaban Delta, I'm Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. FSRN is a worker-run collective, and for more information, visit our website at www.fsrn.org.